Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. There are two significant dates this week in St. Louis. On Saturday, we marked the 25th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But first, today is the day after National Coffee Day. And when it comes to favorite beverages in St. Louis, it may surprise you to learn that coffee does not play second fiddle to beer here. In fact, St. Louis was once called the coffee capital of the country. And that's being noted in a new exhibit opening Saturday at the Missouri History Museum. It's titled Coffee, the World in Your Cup, and St. Louis in Your Cup. It's a traveling exhibit with a large St. Louis component, researched and created right here. Joining me now is Katie Moon, the exhibits manager at the Missouri History Museum. Katie, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is an exciting time for you because it's your inaugural flight, right?
It is. It is. I'm usually behind the scenes, so this is my first full exhibit that I'm doing. It's been very exciting.
Give me a little idea as to how an exhibit like this is set up, how you go about making it happen.
Sure. Well, this one's a little bit of a unique bird because we got it from the Burke Museum, the traveling section about the global history of coffee, and we often will add a local component. And so for this one, we said, well, let's tell the story of coffee in St. Louis. And as I started doing research about it, discovered that there was this history that no one really knew and that we were kind of a big deal back in the day. And so continued to do research and have kind of formed this full exhibit that tells global and local history at the same time.
Well, it surprised me to learn, and getting ready for your appearance here today, some of the things that are being acknowledged in the museum were a big surprise to me, and I've been here for a fairly long time. But you say it was a pretty big deal back in the day. Well, back in the day goes way back, a couple hundred years.
It does. It does. And actually, the oldest artifact that we have in the exhibit is a bill of lading from a steamboat from 1823 that has coffee listed as one of the items that they're bringing from New Orleans to St. Louis. So really, since day one, coffee was part of St. Louis's history.
And the French were a big part of that?
They really were. And because of the New Orleans connection, big connection to France through them, and then also a good shipping route.
You know, I don't often think of the French as coffee drinkers per se. I think if you think of the French, you're probably thinking more along the lines of wine or champagne. But they were big coffee drinkers back a couple hundred years ago?
Definitely. During the French Revolution and a little bit afterwards, it was kind of the hot thing in Paris to go to a coffee house. And they didn't just serve coffee there, but it was definitely on their minds that they were coffee drinkers.
Well, how did it evolve? I mean, the French got it all started. Then what?
They really did. And then, of course, we had German immigration. And they brought coffee with them as well. And
they needed it after all the beer.
They did. They did. Have to sober up somehow. So the German immigrants came, and they also, you know, and of course it was always an economic thing for St. Louisans. It came up the Mississippi River, and then when the railroads were built, it was coming from both of the coasts. And we just took advantage of that economically and started producing coffee in St. Louis.
Does your research go back beyond that as to coffee as a worldwide drink and how that got started and how it became popular in so many different places, or are you pretty much focused on St. Louis?
My research particularly has primarily been about St. Louis, but we do the traveling section of the show includes that global story of coffee. And it is one of those strange things because we think of coffee as such an American beverage that we kind of take ownership of it, but it's not grown here. It's always been something exotic and something that's had to be imported. And so there's all sorts of urban legends and different things about how it's traveled across the world. And unfortunately, we owe a lot of it to slavery and the labor that came from slaves.
What other parts of the world, if you can tell us from your exhibit, other parts of the world is coffee as popular per se as it is here?
We're pretty close to the top. Yeah. Right now, Scandinavian countries are actually the biggest coffee drinkers. So I think Finland is actually number one. But of course, it's all different styles of coffee that people drink. You know, here we like our drip coffee that's not too strong. And in other parts of the world, they still drink Turkish coffee and dark espressos, and which we do here, of course, but that's the mainstay in other countries.
I was surprised to learn, and I'm skipping ahead a little bit here, that It evolved to the degree here in St. Louis that in the 1920s, I believe it was, that St. Louis was considered the coffee capital of the United States.
We really were. We were the largest inland distributor of coffee in the world. And it all started after the Civil War when we decided to take something that was made in by women at home. They would just go and buy green coffee. They would have to take it home, roast it themselves, grind it themselves, brew it themselves, and do all of that work. But then people started working outside of the home, and these coffee merchants decided, let's make it more convenient for people. So they are going to roast it, but also charge more, of course, mm-hmm. for that, and just kept growing along with the population of St. Louis. And so 1900 to 1920 was really kind of it for the coffee trade in St. Louis.
And then what happened? Did it hit a downslope? did beer take over? What happened?
Right. Lots of things happened, primarily on a national scale. Of course, we went into the Great Depression. We had World War I, and advertising really took off in a different way. That these national companies really took off. And St. Louis and the coffee men from the 1880s, 1890s were dying off. And so it was kind of that perfect storm that everything kind of trailed off in the 30s in St. Louis.
How many coffee producers were there here in the heyday?
That is a hard thing hard thing to pin down.
A lot of them.
It's been estimated about 80.
Wow.
At the turn of the century. But you had people that popped up and roasted for 2 years and then disappeared, or they combined with each other. Or it's the most complicated family tree you've ever seen.
Right. And because we were considered the coffee capital of the world, I guess there weren't too many other places that had anything even close to that.
New York was still roasting coffee, Chicago, San Francisco. But people really thought of St. Louis as a place to get coffee, as they were headed west. It was the place to stop and get coffee, but we were also shipping coffee out to other places from here.
Right. You mentioned the roasting process. Mm-hmm. Is that what we did here? I mean, obviously the coffee came from someplace else because we don't grow the coffee beans.
Right, right. It's another one of those weird things. We like to talk about our local businesses and local coffee producers, but coffee isn't grown here, as I said. But yes, we started out as a coffee roasting place. So coffee would come up the Mississippi River on a steamboat, later railroad cars, and we would get the green coffee still in burlap bags or in barrels, and would take it and have these massive, at that time, massive roasters that would hold 50, 100 pounds of coffee and roast it here. And then people would buy the roasted coffee.
And we would send it out to other parts of the country generically, and they would put their own name on it? Or did we send out specific brands?
Yeah. At the beginning, people didn't really care. They didn't know where the coffee came from. They had some idea it was someplace exotic, probably someplace warm, but they weren't buying coffee. They were buying coffee out of a bin. They didn't know if it was, Java or Mocha or whatever. It was for them just coffee.
But we did have famous brands here locally.
We did.
What were some of them?
We did. Probably my favorite one to talk about is the Blanky Tea and Coffee Company.
Blanky?
Blanky. And that name is still, you can hear it around St. Louis and in different places. And we actually have rooms at the museum that are Blanky-supported rooms. And the building still exists on Papin Street. But he was German. He came from Illinois, but his parents were German. And by the World's Fair, he was one of the top employers in St. Louis at the time. Had about 200 employees and was doing a lot of business.
Was coffee a big deal at the fair?
It was. Yeah. It was. It was. It's so strange that it's one of those things that people just don't. They don't even think twice about. But Blanky had several concession stands, and he actually moved Grant's cabin from South St. Louis and moved it to the fairgrounds and had a concession stand out of it, which is just a crazy story. But we owe Saving Grant's Cabin to him.
Wouldn't you love to go back and see what it was like?
I know.
In 1904 in Forest Park. You know, a couple of names come to mind with regard to famous brands. One is, it was a Faust brand that I, right? A Faust?
Yes, and that was actually Blanky's most popular brand.
That's what I thought. Now, I, for a specific reason, I want to ask you about Old Judge Coffee.
Okay.
Tell me about it.
Old Judge Coffee is actually a brand. It's a brand name and was originally made by the David Evans Coffee Company, which was, again, one of those companies that started, I think they went back all the way to 1858 and sold just Evans Coffee for a long time. And the Old Judge name came about 1919, 1920. And they were great marketers, were one of the first companies that did commercials in St. Louis.
Well, you say they were great marketers. we're going to listen to an old commercial, and the audience can judge for itself how great the marketing was. Yeah. I guess it worked, but let's have a listen.
There's no trick to making a cup of good coffee, not when you use Old Judge Coffee. Old Judge is processed in three grinds. Regular grind for percolators, drip grind for dripolators, fine grind for glass coffee makers. Make Old Judge any way you like, and to the strength you prefer. But don't try any magic. Now, should you wish to stretch your coffee budget, Old Judge will make 80 or 90 or 100 cups per pound and still retain its distinctive Old Judge flavor. But brew it the way you like it. No matter how you brew it, no matter how strong you make it, Old Judge is the economical coffee.
For good coffee, don't try magic. Try quality. Enjoy Old Judge Coffee.
Radio was a little bit different back in the day. But Old Judge, give us a little bit more of the story of Old Judge. There was a character that was involved with the commercials, wasn't there?
Oh, so the man that you were hearing was the Old Judge magician. And he so they were actually commercials that were shown on TV. And he would come out and do these 10-second bits that would have these horrible magic tricks at the beginning. Mm. And he would talk about Old Judge Coffee and just have a can there and talk about the qualities of Old Judge and how great it was.
Boy, I don't know about that 100th cup.
No thanks.
We've got to take a break. Let's do that now. We're talking with Katie Moon, the Missouri History Museum Exhibits Manager, and we're talking about an exhibit that's going to be opening at the museum starting on Friday?
Saturday.
Saturday. I beg your pardon.
I love coffee. I love tea. I love the Java Jive, and it loves me. Coffee and tea, and the Java and me. A cup, a cup, a cup, a cup, a cup, boy. I love Java, sweet and hot. Whoops, Mrs. Olsen, I'm a coffee pot. Shoot me
the Java Jive. Java, another word for coffee a lot of people may not realize. Back with Katie Moon from the Missouri History Museum in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.
Till I'm slugging a jug, a slice of onion and a brown one. Draw one.
Waiter, waiter, percolator.
I love coffee, I love tea. I love the Java Jive, and it loves me. Coffee and tea.
Now back to our conversation with Katie Moon, the Missouri History Museum Exhibits Manager. And while we have that on our mind, let's just talk about the exhibit for a moment. Katie, I've got my notes here. That is beginning. It's the World in Your Cup and St. Louis in Your Cup. It opens Saturday and runs through January 3rd.
Yes.
That's the exhibit which you are a big part of. Tell us a little bit more about the exhibit. You mentioned that it's really in two parts, and one part being the St. Louis component. Mm-hmm. The other part, I guess, put together by folks in Seattle. Is that correct?
Yes, it was actually developed by the Burke Museum in Seattle. And so they really looked at the global history of coffee, issues of labor, environment, biodiversity, how coffee, actually baristas make coffee. So definitely lays the groundwork for coffee in St. Louis.
Seattle, I guess, would be the place to put together a traveling exhibit on coffee. That's kind of the coffee capital of the country now, isn't it?
It is. It definitely is.
What do we see when we go to the exhibit?
We see, well, actually, I had an exciting morning because we've spent the last 6 weeks or so putting together a coffee bean mosaic, and it was being hung in the gallery today, and it is 8 feet by 20 feet, and it's made entirely of coffee beans, and it's the cityscape of St. Louis. So that's actually the first thing that visitors will see when they walk into the exhibit, so it's very exciting. And then they'll actually walk through the St. Louis section of the exhibit, lots of fun artifacts for them to look at. There's actually a Civil War gun in there that has a coffee mill in it. Different ways to roast and brew coffee is in there. Some industrial equipment. And then we talk about selling St. Louis coffee. So lots of advertisements. And then we also include, of course, Dana Brown. We have some of Dana Brown's commercials playing in the exhibit. And then there's a chance also for people to leave their own coffee memories and share why coffee is important for them. And then finally, we actually finish up with the Burke section of the exhibit.
I'll ask our listening audience if they have coffee memories they'd like to share with us. So we'd love to have you give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email to talk@stopublicradio.org. If you would prefer to send a tweet, we would love to hear from you that way as well. My guest here in studio is Katie Moon from the Missouri History Museum. You mentioned Dana Brown. I think people of a certain age who would be listening will remember him. He was very active here. How important was he to the St. Louis coffee world?
He was very important. At a time when coffee kind of had a bad rap, in the 50s and the 60s, coffee was popular, but it just wasn't good. He came around. He actually started as a salesman for Manhattan Coffee and ended up buying Manhattan Coffee and becoming its president, and then selling it and starting his own Safari Coffee, which people, I'm sure, remember. And he was all about marketing, all about advertising. And he was an interesting character on all levels. And so we touch on that a little bit in the exhibit. But he really, a lot of people think that's when St. Louis coffee history started. And so he was very pivotal in kind of bringing it back and starting coffee being important again.
What I remember about Dana Brown was he did all of his own commercials.
He did. He did. And we actually had a great opportunity to work with the Film and Media Archive at Washington University. And they've let us borrow all of the footage that they had, pictures. We actually have his hat and his safari shirt that will go on display. But they have... they have all of his media archives, and we had to choose. And I think we have 11 of his commercials that'll be shown in the exhibit.
You have a video screen of some sort, obviously, for that sort of thing.
We do. We actually, I feel like I'm giving things away, but we actually have an old Zenith console TV and a 70s looking couch. And so we've essentially set up a living room so people can come and pretend like it's the early 80s and watch those commercials.
Who else might be considered pivotal in the coffee history of this town?
Well, definitely Blanky. For the Forbes Coffee Company claimed to be the first company to roast coffee west of the Mississippi. Of course, you've got Old Judge. There's another company called Hanley and Kinsella that were really big. And actually, as a group, they formed what is now known as the National Coffee Association. But they, as a group of coffee merchants, started getting together as early as 1885.
Why was coffee bad in the 50s, as you indicated a couple of moments ago?
So it's a bit of a kind of a long story, but long story short, when the women used to roast it and grind it at home, they at least knew what they had and could have some control over quality. But as soon as it started being industrialized and it was this convenience and it was consistent, but it was consistently bad because they could add in all sorts of different things. So you didn't really know what you were getting. Mm-hmm. And in order to make it stretch further, the quality just wasn't there. They were using a cheaper quality of beans and just putting coffee on the label.
They put chicory and things like that in it, I suppose, which they do in New Orleans, which makes that fairly unique, but gives it a bitter taste, I think, but that's me.
Right. Well, really, before the Food and Drug Safety Act was passed in 1906, it was a free-for-all. They could put sawdust, chicory, whatever they wanted. So after that, there were a bit more control. There was a bit more control on it, but they could still play around with the quality of the coffee beans and the roast.
Let's take a couple of phone calls. Great. Folks are responding to this, and we'll start with Elena calling from St. Louis. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
I remember as a five-year-old child traveling with my family from California to Omaha, and we'd sit on the front porch late at night, and we'd, you know, there were the fire bugs and fireflies, and I still can remember the smell of coffee roasting. It would just waft from the factory. And at that time, it was a brand called Folgers. And of course, after maybe 5-10 years, the factory closed. And when I'd go back and visit, that's one thing I miss.
Thank you so much for the call. Well, Folgers is still around, I think, isn't it?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Yeah, were you finished, Elena? I'm sorry. I thought you had finished.
Oh, yes. Thank you for taking this call. Bye.
Thank you for giving us a call. We have a tweet here from Ann who says that she remembers when you could afford a cup of coffee in a diner. coffee's getting pretty expensive these days if you want to go the Starbucks route or some of those places.
Definitely, yeah. Definitely. It's interesting, though, because now that we know more about how coffee is harvested and processed and how much labor goes into it, I think people are actually becoming more willing to pay more for coffee.
There seems to be a resurgence of sorts in coffee houses, if you will, specialty places for coffee. Mm-hmm. Are you thinking the same thing?
Definitely, definitely. And it's been great to be able to talk to some of those roasters and shop owners who are really passionate about what they do. And the term I like to use is we're re-exotifying coffee. We're taking it kind of out of the American consciousness and talking about where it comes from and that it is an exotic foreign thing that we should maybe pay more to have a whole experience, like wine.
Right. Well, there are so many things that are added to it anymore that cause the price to go up, too. I mean, some of these things you can buy at a Starbucks, for instance, can be very expensive and also have many more ingredients than coffee.
Right, right. Yeah. And I think there's been research done that the dairy people are making a lot of money off of coffee today.
Good. Let's take another call. We'll bring in Rich calling from the Bevo neighborhood. Rich, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi, Don. Thanks for taking my call again. Noticing if you happen to frequent Tower Grove Park, as I do, as I've mentioned before on this show, that as the winds shift to a more northerly direction, rather than smelling the barley mash from the brewery, you can smell coffee being roasted somewhere in the neighborhood between Manchester Avenue and Market Street. And well, that's pretty much all I have to say about it today. Thanks.
Thank you for the call. Yeah, a lot of memories like that.
Yeah. And there still is a coffee area. If you drive down 44, you can see Renoco and Caldi's both have their roasting plants right off of 44. And you can, at certain times of day, still smell the roasting coffee.
Is that pretty much it for St. Louis now in terms of the roasting and the production?
Oh, heavens no. We have at least 20 roasters in St. Louis, some bigger than others. Renoco is definitely the largest, but Chauvin, Caldi's, just to name some of the bigger ones.
Well, those names are familiar to, I'm sure, most of the folks listening. Let's take another call. Jay joins us from Normandy. Go ahead, Jay. You're on the air.
Yeah, you said the coffee of the 50s wasn't very good, but I remember going in the A&T stores, grocery stores, and it seemed like they had the special machines and you had bags. I'm not a coffee drinker, but I just remember my parents, how they would, you'd have this machine, they'd get a bag and you'd put it up to the machine and it would pour out. So it surprised me that you say that the 50s era coffee wasn't that great, since it was sort of interesting the way it came out. That's all I've got. Thanks.
They still have them, I think.
They do. And actually, that was A&P was known for their 8 o'clock brand, which we can still buy today. I think your parents were probably one of a select few who were picky about their coffee at that mm-hmm. time. But you can also take good coffee and make it not good by not putting enough in, or even percolators will make it taste different than a drip pot. And so there's so many factors involved.
When did people start putting stuff in coffee? I mean, the average drinker putting sugar and cream and that sort of thing, as opposed to just taking it straight.
Right. Well, that actually it's been around for several hundred years. So you find old recipes that still say coffee is better with some sugar and some milk in it. And so that's been happening for a really long time. I think black coffee was more of a wartime era mm-hmm. thing in St. Louis and across the country.
We'll take another call, this time from the Hill. Mike joins us. Mike, thanks for coming in. You're on the air.
Hi, Don.
Hi.
Yeah, some 55 years ago, or maybe more, I was a teenager in Cincinnati. We're German-born, but my mother insisted on making really good coffee, and we had a Melitta, one of those glass filter things, and it was a real ritual of grinding the coffee and putting in a certain amount and tempering it and adding a little more, and always using clean coffee cups. No mugs at the time, and so it was a real ritual back then. And of course, now it's pretty hot to do that.
Ritual is a big association with coffee.
It really is, and we owe a lot of our coffee rituals and good coffee to immigrants into St. Louis. You know, Germans coming in had their own special way of making coffee. I had the opportunity to speak with a Bosnian man who owns Barrick's Restaurant, who still makes Turkish coffee, roasts and grinds and serves Turkish coffee at his restaurant. And Bosnian culture brings such a rich tradition of drinking coffee. And it's not just – that's what we like to say. It's never just about coffee. It's about tradition. It's about labor. It's about the environment. It's about so many other things than just coffee.
It's one of the most important commodities in the world.
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
I remember last year at the museum, we started getting a different kind of coffee, and I thought we were going to have – a revolt.
Right.
And, you know, it's one of those things we really depend on. It's part of our Army's rations that they get.
Got time for one more call. Let's bring in Fred calling from Glendale. Fred, thanks for being with us. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, listen, back in the 1940s, my dad was a huge coffee drinker, and he had a big record collection. And out of that collection, one of my favorite songs was "I Like Coffee, I Like Tea" by the Mills Brothers. And I would recommend for all today's coffee lovers, if they can get a copy of that, they'll love it.
Well, we played a segment of that tune a little earlier. It was from a college quartet.
Right. The Mills Brothers are the originals.
I mentioned as we were listening to that, the Mills Brothers version, which I remember growing up.
Oh,
as a
you
kid.
Do. You remember.
I remember. Yeah,
come on.
Yeah, I remember. I remember the Mills Brothers.
I know
Fred,
you do.
Thanks so much for the call.
Yeah, right. Bye.
Katie, we're going to have to say goodbye and wish you all the best as your exhibit begins. I'll remind folks once again that the Missouri History Museum exhibit Coffee, the World in Your Cup, and St. Louis in Your Cup opens this Saturday and runs through January 3rd. Okay?
Yes, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for being with us, and great success with the exhibit. It's going to be great. I can't wait to see it.
Thank you.
We'll be back in just a moment. Word on an event of a different sort at the museum when we come back. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.